On the last day, side 2 of Teeth 3, we were on religion, and this is side 1 of Teeth 4, which is being recorded on the 1st of April 1996 by Angus MacLeod. And we were talking about the congregations of Crossbuster, which broke up and set up in Carlowe, in Gravel, and in Kinloch. And Shawvest as well. So that was 4 free church. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in all, including Crossbuster, 5 free church congregations, where the one in Cowes was the 4. Shawvest in 1894. And then United Free. Control Shift 1900, which I'm sure you were aware of. Another few congregations happened then. Carlowe was a new United Free Church in Carlowe, one in Kinloch, one in Lourdes, and one in Gravel. That was another 4, that was 9 in all now. Where we had one before. And then the next thing that happened, 1929, the United Free Church Congregations, Church of Scotland in 1929. And these four joined the Church of Scotland. And in 1971, Callanish area set up another free church that they broke away from Carlowe. So what was that? 5 and 4 is 9, that's 10 now. They formed a free church of their own in Carlowe. And in 1955, Limerick left the free church at Gravel and they set up a Church of Scotland. What was that? Was that 10? And of course there was a free Presbyterian presence in Callanish at that war. So this we see that at the end of the 20th century there are 12 congregations in the area of the original Kells Parish Church. Well, that's not unity or whatever it is. But you tell them to get together. And of course, now there are more splinters even in the road time. ABC, is that what you call them? ABC. People's material are beginning to splinter as well. And not going into politics or religion just now, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's more splinters in the near future as well. Things are not too good in the religious circle. And that's a great pity. Now, the point, I think, if you were to comment on that at all, one of the points that you would make is that at one time there was room for a number of congregations, but now all these, some of these, if not all of them actually, are getting small. Some of them are so small that they no longer exist. You see, the Limerick congregation, it only lasted a few years. Well, anybody could tell them that. You can't tell religious fanatics anything. The other ones I'm not going to mention them, as you know yourself, some of them are pretty small. And they have a problem now. they're going to maintain their independence and put out their tongue to the other folk going down to the other church and keep going to their own or whatever. The expansion of congregations was all right in the 19th century, and perhaps in the first half of that, the first part anyhow, first quarter anyhow, of the 20th century. But we're in a different ballgame now. So you figure what you can make out of that. There isn't, certainly isn't room in part for two congregations. Hardly room for one there. And it's tough to the people of Limerick to go and take off over nothing. You see, if they were arguing about something, you wouldn't mind. All these arguments that we have known in my time in Limerick are all about nothing. No principles involved. Now, the only thing, other thing that I do more I've got to say about religion, we walked, as I said before, the people of South Loch made their way to Crossbus, across the moor and across the sea. And then even in our time, when I walked, many a time there, from Calvus through the moor to Graver, a distance of 5 miles. But you wouldn't find too many people walking 5 miles through the moor to our religious service nowadays. But that is, you see, I would like to point out the way that our culture has changed and our religious culture has changed in my time very much so. And I think you're going to see a lot of changes in religion as the time goes, as we enter into 21st century. Well, it was very nice walking there. We were young, but casting our minds back, the old people were walking there as well. They discussed the sermon from each various points. The preacher raised as we walked leisurely home, and halfway down we sat there for a while, on top of a hill, and so we were entertained. Not the tradition, but with the culture that was there. You see, none of these things if it doesn't occur to you, I said that we were walking to church through the moor. And there wasn't a road between Campbell's and Grammar, but there was a road between, round the other way, between Marywood to Grammar. And in the late 1920s and 30s, bicycles came in. And some of the older folk, I think including the minister as well, some of the older folks on the right, taking like this, church with a bicycle. You know, well, that's us all over, you see. Certainly nothing wrong with that bicycle. And then you, of course, you see the cars came. Of course, you see, the minister and the elders and everybody else took to the cars as well. If you were today to tell them to stop taking their bicycle and their cars to church, they would stone you. Buses. Well, I mention that because these are the changes, the cultural changes, the social changes that we have seen in our day. We've seen a lot of change. I don't know if there's anything else on religion, but I'll end my subject of religion just now at that point. Thank you. Incidentally, I didn't mention when I was talking about religion of the village prayer house. I don't know if you had a village prayer house in Rhanish because you were near enough to cross post. But it is a feature of our culture. We have a weekly prayer meeting, and if you're going to talk about these things, perhaps you could mention that as well. I should also make another point here. As far as I'm personally concerned, anyhow, I think the influence of religion in the island has been the main agency in promoting the progress of civilization down through the centuries. And when the restraints of religion was absent, as in the very distant past, confusion and a state of anarchy prevailed. Well, I don't know what you think about that, but I draw your attention to my view there. The aim of the Scottish reformers in 1560 was to have both a church and a school in every parish. Somewhat late, as I said before, coming to this part, but that was so that religion and education are closely related. In Scotland, anyhow. The Scottish Reformation was as much educationally orientated as religiously almost. And I'm sure you're all aware of the history of that. So I want to turn over to education now. Then again, another point occurred to me. La Kisht is an institution in Lewes, and I have it somewhere around here there, when that started. La Kisht was installed. Maybe hold on, let's see if I can find it. Well, La Kisht, actually, the old audience, community services, you would take the old community services in. And since we're talking about La Kisht, we take that first. The men's day, as they call it, or the question day, or the fellowship, self-examination. The first men's day meeting held in the island was said to be on in 1825 or 26 at a Stornoway communion season. And the words of the text were, "The hope of the hypocrite shall perish." Job 8, verse 13. And as usual, the brethren were asked to distinguish between the hope of the hypocrite and the hope of the child of God. A question was opened by Mr. McBain, who was at that time the inspector of the school set up by the Edinburgh Gaelic Society. And I'm not going to tell you too much about that. That's well known. But 10 or so of the men applying to set out the marks of Christian. First of all, one or other of the leading men will rise to announce a suitable portion of scripture. And he hadn't discussed that with anybody. The minister, it's not a prearranged thing. It is descriptive, the portion should be descriptive of an experience common to true believers. And he asked the speaker to give, from their own experience, scriptural marks of the saving grace of God in a true believer. as distinct from a person who might think erroneously that he himself bears the true marks of grace in the heart. The presiding minister, as you know, which is usually a visiting minister, opens a question. It's a traumatic experience. I would think it's a very dramatic experience to rise in the middle of a big congregation, giving a good account of yourself. And it is a thing that helped these churchmen to get self-confidence. And from that point of view, it's good as well as and the purpose of it is pre-communion on Sunday. It's for everybody, particularly young communicants, considered eligible. Yeah, salad, eligible. Now, the only other point of making these questions is that services are very much short now. And they used to be services very long, even in May. And another feature of that is that there were two and even three communion tables. There's only one now everywhere. It's not so long ago since they discontinued two. We used to have three in Grand. And in that connection, may I quote somebody, Macramore said at one time, is that in a letter to a minister friend, he referred to a communion at Barras, and he informs us, the day was cold, as I quote, the day was cold, but the service was short. Began at 11:45 and finished at 4:15 with 6 tables. That was quick work for you. So you see there you are, Macramore thought it was quick work to from 11:45 to 4:15, 6 tables. Now anybody in the church nowadays you can try that one out. With all those comforts, huh? So that is the measure of the way things are changing in all departments, religion, church, and everything else. Before I leave the religion, another thought occurred to me, and that is the way the men of Lourdes, without going any further, the men of Lourdes as a whole, went all over the world with the gospel. There was a China Inland missionary from Harpers. Three brothers were ministers. Brother Talia Harpers, 10 Harpers, uncles of John MacLeod, Yan Talia and Harpers, still in Harpers. And one of them was a Church of Scotland, one of them was a China Inland missionary. And so was his son. And his son's son is preaching in Canada even now. And then even our own village where we sent out a number of people, and one of them is, and one of them, Neil MacLeod, Dr. Neil MacLeod, is in Australia yet. He, in Slough Beach, in Australia, and he was moderator of the church over there several times. And he was a lecturer in the university as well. And then again, you see, you will have heard about the Iron Church of Stornoheigh, where they went down to the Clyde and built an iron church because they couldn't get a site in Stornoheigh. And there was a man from Cashel that was a minister of that church at one time, Alexander MacLeod. It's on Croft 1-2, Cashel there. One of the MacLeods at Cashel, but all these MacLeods were very evil people. And that is the MacLeods of Ian MacLeod, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So, there it was. Now, coming to education, and I'm quite sure you are very familiar with the history of education, the early history of education, and we owe a lot to the Society for the Support of Gaelic Schools, which were formed in Edinburgh in 1811. And they set up a number of Gaelic schools from that time onwards. I don't know about the schools on that side of the loch, but there's a number of schools on the other side, in almost all the villages. The correct date. And anyhow, I can't find the dates, but there are schools set up on the other side in Grammar and Cromwell, Lameroy. And there were schools that were moving, actually, they moved from one village to another, in many cases. And there was in 1824, the Church of Scotland set up a permanent education committee, and in the 1860s they had 29 schools in the Hebrides in the 1860s, but only one of these were in the Leeds. So the Church of Scotland, and then the Free Church came into existence of that school, and we owe our education system largely to these Gaelic schools, the Edinburgh Gaelic schools, and our religion, both. And I'm sure that that's amazing. And then in 1865, Alexander Morrison Nicholson, a Louis engineer, died at the age of 33 at Shanghai, China, as a result of an accident. He left a will giving one third of his entire property for a school in his native town. By 1875, the Nicholson Institute of Astronomy was opened. You see, there you are, 1875, the Nicholson Institute. In 1872, we have the Education Act, and the school was set up following that act. And can I see if I have a note of school today? Now, here we are now. That was an interruption again. So, we're back on education again, and the 1872 Act, as far as Lewis is concerned, four school boards were set up in Lewis in March or April of 1873, four parish school board of Louis were formed. The members of the school board for Lotz were as follows. Donald Monroe, that is the solicitor and the chamberlain of Stornoway. He was chairman of all four, as he was of a whole lot of other things. Roderick Miller, surgeon. Reverend Ewan Campbell, the parish minister of Lough. Reverend George Louis Campbell, the fee church minister of Lough. Donald MacDonald, tenant Crapick, was a favourite man. John Mackay, ground officer for Lala. And Kenneth Mackenzie, Gaelic teacher, Carway. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven members of the school board. The first meeting of the Lough School Board, held at Sawell Lodge in April 1873, Mr. Monroe was appointed chairman, and Mr. William Ross, solicitor Stornoway, was appointed to the conjoined officer of clerk and treasurer at a salary of £50 per annum. Mr. Vernon Monroe was the chairman of each, as I said before, of the, each of the four school boards, and he wasn't doing his job very good, and there were some resignations, but I'll leave that. In December 1873, the children aged between 5 and 13 years, in the five proposed school areas of South Lough, were as follows. You see, there was a count of all the children. Now, there was to be five schools in Lough, and Habost, Cashotter, Gerivard, and Cavertry was to be the school at Cashotter. There were 25 children in Cashotter, 20 in Gerivard, 25 children in Habost, rather, 20 in Cashotter, 18 in Gerivard, and 10 in Cavertry, 73 in all. And then the second school in South Lough, Cromore School, there was 55 children in Cromore, and 2 in Crapick, and 4 in Tarasta, 61 in all of the Cromore School. Now the Marwick School again was 57 children in Marwick and 41 in Culbus, 98 children in Marwick and Culbus. And in Graver there was 83 children for Graver alone, and in Limeraway there was 101. Well, there wasn't Orissey at that time. So the total children in South Lough alone was 416 children. At the Lough School Board meeting of 2nd June 1876, it was agreed to accept a contract offer for £13,325 from Alexander MacDonald, contractor, Lynedale, Isle of Skye, for 9 schools in the parish of Lough. 9 schools in the parish of Lough for £13,325, including the 5 schools in South Lough, all with dwelling houses. Imagine that. An average of about 1,500 per school, with dwelling houses included. Now, I'll give you the opening dates of South Lough, which I was particularly interested in. Castor School opened in 1878, Cromore School in 1879, Planisker School, Marwick, that's what they call it, Planisker, in 1880, Graver and Limeraway in 1881. So the 5 schools in South Lough opened from 1878 to 1881, which is a very commendable speed for a contractor. I doubt if you could get any contractor to build 5 schools in a few years now. But nevertheless, quite a few years after the passing of the Education Act, before everything was got together. Now, the children were charged school fees to begin with, but compulsory education became free in 1889. The school holidays were 8 weeks, and that reminds me, I think I have perhaps a thesis of somebody from Burmese that run and repeated his thesis in the Gazette on education in Lewis. I would look that out. You might find interesting information there on the way he went about it. 8 weeks school holidays, 5 weeks in spring, commencing on 28th March, and 3 weeks in autumn, commencing on 12th September. A free breakfast of porridge was provided to all school children in the parish in 1888. Bowls of oatmeal were distributed in the district for that purpose. So you see, people weren't all that well off at that time. So I have a list of the schoolmasters that was in my old school. And perhaps some of the other ones over there. I think I didn't consult that, but I think the school records are in Stornoway. And they came back to Stornoway, I think. So you could, if you like, consult that. You'll have so much to write that you want. Well, you see, the attendants, your old people over there will tell you that the attendants were what we called a whipper-in. So he came after you if you absented yourself from school too often. And we did as often as we could, unfortunately. We could live our lives again. We would attend to school a little better. We're all wiser in hindsight, aren't we? So it's to be noted that it was up to 13 that the thing was. I can't remember when it went to 14. So it was in 14 in our time, and later on it went to 16, as it is now. We got corporal, probably you didn't that and get that in Ron, she would run home. We had to corporal in school. And you took a peek to school also. And that continued until the early 1920s, if I remember right. So, there you are now, that's the school. It's a new school. There was a new school replaced. The five schools in South Park was replaced by the Park New School. It was opened on 26 September 1973 by Group Captain Reverend Motto Kennedy MacLeod, MA, PhD, formerly Principal Chaplain, Royal Air Force, who was born at Calvost in 1897 and received his education at Plans School, Marwick. So, as you know, they are now talking about closing the schools on the other side and opening one in the end of Lurbost. And I think that would be a lot better. So you would have eventually probably two schools in lots where all these nine schools were. In fact, 10 or 11. You will remember that they put up a small one in a mall later on and a small one in Crimpshire as well. So there was 11 there eventually. If you were to look at the picture on the broader scale, you see the Reformation 1560, an act in 1660 Parliament, ordered that a school and schoolmaster was to be provided for every parish in Scotland, with the landowner making the school available and paying the schoolmaster's salary. Further acts were passed in 1633, 1646, 1696, and there you are, in 1700, a number of philanthropic gentlemen in Edinburgh anxious to improve education facilities in the remoter areas of the Highlands. You see, these landlords wouldn't bother too much about providing schools. They did provide a little, must be said, but it was the voluntary organisations, such as the Edinburgh Gaelic and the SSPCK and Scornelletti, and you know, the ladies' school and all that. That was a free church. You see, they called it Scornelletti. Scolan Chius, they called the other ones, because the Gaelic school, the main textbook was the Bible, and one of the ideas was to get the people to read and write in their own, particularly to read in their own language. And they never read the Bible until not only the small ones, but the grown-ups went to school as well. And that was the first opportunity of reading the Bible. So there were stories of a young man from Limerick going up after that, Neil Nicholson going up after that testament in his pocket, the New Testament, and whenever he came across somebody that could read, he promptly pulled out his testament, got them to read his testament for him. So, you see, things have come a long way from since then. And these are things we could go over it again. Give me some of these old files I have here. Keep you going all winter. Yes, I don't think I had the dates of these schools in Marwick. I've just come across them now. Graver opened, that's a Gaelic school. The Graver opened in 1822, Marwick in 1828, Lochshell in 1828, Cremorne in 1829, Kershaw in 1832. So you see, the parish school, as I said before, at Cowes, that was an English school, 1796. And they were all small thatched schools, and at the way of that, the church was in Cowes. You see, Cowes was the capital. Church was in Cowes, everything was in Cowes. And Cross was given the scene. Cowes lost some of its glory. If you look at Robert Finlayson's second statistical report written in 1833, he says there were only 12 people in the parish of Loughs that could write, and you may be sure they were either the children of the minister or the taxman. Or you may be sure that the whole of Loughs couldn't read or write, even in 1833. However, half of the inhabitants of the parish between the ages of 12 and 24 could read the Gaelic language, thanks to the Gaelic school. That's what he says. Mm-hmm. examples of the way things were. Sheriff Nicholson, in his report on education, I've got a date for that. Well, that thing. I might come to that again. Spoke of his pleasure at witnessing so much bright and eager intelligence. However, his pleasure was mixed with pain at seeing these children associated with poverty and ruggedness. He knew that they were fit for better things, but lacked the opportunity of a reasonable start. Inevitably, they would end up as labourers and fishermen. That is because they didn't have the opportunity. There were 47 schools in Lewis before the 1872 Act, yet half the Lewis children were not receiving any formal education. That's a glance, that's a snippet of that. Now, another interesting snippet here, the voluntary schools did valuable work in their small thatched schoolhouses with no facilities or even seating. In his report in 1858, the Ladies Association School Superintendent stated that four people were in a Latin class in Tremore, one of them a girl, the first female classical scholar he encountered in the Outer Hebrides. So you see, you have the same material back then, but there wasn't the same opportunities as there is now. Take for instance kind of the Mackenzie Ford Graver Cuyuhan Havard, born in 1856. He would be 25 years old when the Graver School opened under the 1872 Act. He must therefore have received his early education in the voluntary school or in the parish school, of course. You see, it's quite amazing if you look back at how well some of these people did before there was education. He kind of ended up as the head teacher of the Inheim School in Graver. At the Inheim School in Lewis. That's on the west side. It was stated that he was the first honours graduate in Lewis. Well, that was... He was 25 when these schools opened. So, people like that. I referred earlier to Stroyne-Heeran School. Well, the name of the minister there was Reverend Alistair MacLeod, Alistair Chalam Rooyi. He was born in 1827 at Kesselton. And he would attend the parish school in Georgia. That was just across the lawn. And perhaps they had, I don't know, but they had relatives over there. He was ordained in 1868 at Stroyne-Heeran Free Church, and he preached in the Floating Iron Church in Loch Soonart for years. See, there was always bright people that float to the top, no matter what. I see that my tape is coming to an end, and this is my last tape, and there's still one side to do, or something else on the other side. I think I've said enough on schools, education. Give you the whole of that side on education. On religion and education, the whole of that side of religion, education before that. I I think I'll leave her him just now. Craft work, which we could discuss sometime. Now, the other thing is heritage and all that, but we'll bring these out in discussion. And the social change that you have seen, we could bring that out in discussion. And that would leave me with just Harris Tweed as the only remaining big heading to cover. And what I'll do with Harris Tweed is I'll look if I have something written on Harris Tweed that I could pass on to. That's a big subject anyhow, so I remember giving a talk in Malala, so perhaps I'll get that paper, copy of that paper out. Give you the basis of it. Ushakski Yamsanish Makich. I think I come now to my last subject for the time being anyhow, and it's high time, the subject being Harris Tweed. And I'll introduce the subject at the end of this side of the tape and make a few comments at the beginning of the next tape. And I looked and found a copy of the talk I gave in Louvois in March 1993. And I will give you that. As you know, these talks, when one makes them, they're geared to the likely audience that is there, and perhaps there are aspects of the industry which I have not touched on there because perhaps it wasn't suitable to touch on in that audience. I will look through it and this is the second side of take 4. It is recorded on the 1st of April 1996. And I made a few remarks about the Harris Tweed industry at the end of side 1 of the same team. And I mentioned that I was giving you a copy of my talk in Lourmost on the Harris Tweed industry. In March 1993, and I'll just make a few comments on it because I'll hand the thing over to you. And you got Denny called my brother here. Now, as you may understand, cloth and yarn was made from the beginning of time, I suppose, in the home, domestically, both from wool and flax and other things, hemp and other things. And we're more concerned here with wool. I don't know if I said this before, if not, it will tell me to say it again anyhow, that our way of life, the economy of crafting economy, rests on three legs, and that is crafting, fishing, and textiles. Traditionally, that was the case, branching out now into various other things. Crafting means Dixon, agriculture, cattle and sheep and all these things. Now coming to textiles, which is what we are talking about here, the earliest form of making yarn was the distaff, D-A-S-D, quicker, C-U-A-G-E, and I'll try and get an illustration of a quicker that I'll send along with this deed if I can. I have one written. Now, may I explain what a quicker is, because perhaps you're not very used to it. Quicker was used extensively. It simply a piece of wood, some 3 feet long, perhaps rounded, 1.5 inches rounded, or a little more than an inch thick, rounded piece of wood, with the one end of it flattened, say 8 inches of one end of it flattened, and you wrapped some wool around the end of it, and you put it under your left arm, with the end, with the wool on it, sticking out in front of you. And you took the wool off as you spun it. So you started by taking the bit of the wool off and attaching it to the spindle. The distaff and the spindle go together. Chawaka, spindle, chawaka. And that's the only form of spinning. Now, on the jalakan, it was a narrow jalakan. We are used to it, it's a very heavy one, very much heavier one. The earlier ones were thinner, narrow, and they had a flywheel on. And that was a stone whorl, W-H-O-R-L, that's what they called it. And that was slipped onto the spindle to make it easier to whirl around. If I could get a... Now, jalakan is sometimes called fjarrar, which is held in the opposite hand. And you give it a sharp twist with the forefinger. And in that way, you put the twist into the yarn. Now, strangely, but I've seen on television not so long ago, a year or two ago, something like that being used in Southeast Asia. And I have come across a number of school teachers who were quite adept at using the distaff and spindle. I suppose they learned it at college. Before I go on, I'd like to say a word or two about the whorl. I have a whorl here. It's a round disc, about 1 1/8 inches, 1 1/8 inches diameter. You know, as big as a penny, an old penny, so a 1/2 inch thick. Usually made of soft stone. And a hole of 3/8 inch diameter in the middle to slip it onto to the jalaka, the distaff, as a flywheel theory. Now, the women in times of old used to spin out where they were tending the cow, particularly when they were tending the cow, and out at the out at the Allian where they were attending the cattle out there, and they used to lose these whorls, clochan, and when people found them much later on, I couldn't understand what they were, and the tradition arose that they were clochan narrow. That it was the settlements, the Nahad, that was creating these, making that, these clothing, with their saliva somehow, they thought. and they were used for healing purposes. For instance, if the cow had a sprained ankle or anything like that, they would use Clough Narrow when water, and they sprinkled the water from the Clough Narrow on an affected part, and supposed to have it right. So, that's all that is gone now. You may ask the people over there, wouldn't they? What do they remember of hearing that? Now, while I'm on that, I might add that when they were creating the airport in Stornoway, or lettering it in 1941, a burial chamber was uncovered well below the surface of the ground, where a whole stone, a weaving comb, and pottery, and another stone weight with a hole in the middle of it, a small stone weight, was uncovered. It was held that it was the grave of a woman, and that the tools she was using was buried with her. It was estimated that the grave was perhaps 2,000 years old. So they were not the Sudan, there was folk here 2,000 years ago. the grave proves that weaving this grave, or that grave proves that weaving was done then. With a weaving comb, that's days before looms were invented. Used long time ago. Now, these things are in Stornoway, in the Stornoway Museum, I believe. These three things, at least. And unfortunately, fragments of pottery that was in that grave was taken over to Gravel by a man that was working there. No trace left of that. So that's how a lot of these things are lost. So there it was, you see, the earlier spinning was by distaff and spindle. And in due course the card came in, and the dyeing of the wool and all that. Now, within our time, shall I say, I go back to the beginning of the 19th century. There was no looms and none like that in Louis. And I cannot tell you when the Bertwig came in, right enough. Might have been at that time or before. But the Bertwig, you see, I want to refer to that now, seeing you spoke about it. The Bertwig, you threw the shuttle through, like the table gnomes they have in school, except that it was a bigger, much bigger thing. But you threw the shuttle with your hand through the aft, and you caught it with the other hand at the other side, and threw it back with the hand. And then you see the Bertwig came in, probably noted that in the paper I wrote. Well, the Bertwig came to Louis in the 1890s, early 1890s. My mother owned on the Bertwig before that. And indeed, everybody that wove in Louis before 1890 wove on the Bertwig. Now, I don't need to go over the way Pete Hendersley started. I think, look at that. The dim of her eyes came in and began to commercialize Harris Tweed. Harris Tweed was at that time, before that time, it was made for domestic purposes. Although some might have been sold as cladding, but you see, they made their own cloths as blankets and all that, and cloth for wearing, trousers and all that. And they dyed it with vegetable dyes. Well, I think I have a note of some vegetable dyes somewhere, but I don't know my kids and leave that, but if necessary, I could look it up. But the Congested District Border, which was at the end of the 19th century on to 1912, I think 1896 or about to 1912, was very useful, and they provided a boiler, and we have one in Culver's yet, a dying ball boiler, which was distributed by the Congested District Board. And they also helped greatly with the processes, such as Jilliff and dyeing and all that, and designing. They sent a designer onto the island, and he went to Stornoway. In fact, he was still in Stornoway when I remember, and I saw it. He must have been a young man when he came up at the turn of the century sometime, I think. And he was still there, and his daughter after him. Now, I could give you a picture of the three things that was found at the airport. It might help you. Well, now, in the course of time, and people started sending their wool to be carded to the mainland. And, that was a short step from carding it to spinning it on the mainland. So they didn't do it first, and it isn't coming slowly. And Scott, the proprietor of North Harris, established a small carding mill at Turbert. And Ineas Mackenzie established another small carding mill in Stornoway, which is the forerunner of Newark's mill. Now, Ineas Mackenzie had a timber yard there, and a boat building yard, Peyton Slip. Wool mills is what it was called. Slip, bait and slip, referred to the boatyard, you see. So what Ineas Mackenzie did, a very generous person was Ineas Mackenzie, he had machinery in that yard anyhow. So he put another belt round and put a small card on it and carded the wool from the crofters. And in due course, the spinning wheel, of course, I should have mentioned the spinning wheel on the cards. The spinning wheels, and there are various designs, you see, there's a different design in Shetland, and our own design, and Macrae. McCreeny, the undertaker made, arching spinning wheels, and indeed made looms as well, wooden looms. Now, perhaps I shouldn't say too much more about that. I should think that most of it is in the notes I made there. But before I finish, I think I will make some reference to a small particular. And that was what I did myself. Selling in the home and export markets. And, well, all sorts of dirty things I said about them tycoons and whatnot. But they helped to develop the tweed, the Irish tweed industry also before the mills, like spinner and all that came in. The merchants did, you see, money was in short supply. And the merchants accepted anything that they could turn a penny out of. All the good people were keen to give them anything they had anyhow, and among the things they gave them was wool. Maybe they weren't going to do anything at all, so they sold it to, and they bought bread with it. And unfortunately, these things were abused by some of the merchants. The truck system came in to some extent. But to begin with, these merchants, very often they were forced to take even finished tweeds from them. Usually the families made a tweed from the domestic wool. And when they couldn't sell it, try to get the merchant to take it, and the merchant was forced to take it in some cases. In that way, these local merchants, I'm talking about grocery merchants now, local merchants became tweed merchants in a way. They had a number of tweeds on their hands, and they tried to sell them. In that way, they gradually came into the tweed. So, in due course, you see, they themselves started making tweed, long before mills came, long before there were any mills made tweeds. And much of the helmet in Balala and Pont-Luc in Stornoway, and McKeever of Bayhead, and various people like that were Alec Macaulay of Stornoway, probably tell you about these people, over in your own way. And eventually, you see, they got the ore stamp. Agitation started for them because they started copying the tweed that the crofters were making here. So they started agitating for a stamp in 1906, but it was 1909, or actually 1911 before it was applied. And that was a hand-woven, hand-spun and hand-woven stamp. So you see, even at that early time, there was no word about a machine spinning or anything like that. But by that time, they had started, early in the century, they had started sending a whole load for Cardi. And in the second decade of this century, they had begun to get it spun on the mainland too. So you see, the domestic industry, which was a hand-spun industry, a hand-woven, gradually went over to spinning until one of the Stornoway people, actually a locksman again, Mackenzie's is a locksman. His family, it was his family that was in crossbows, you see. And they moved over to Krabbe because he was married to a girl from Krabbe. And it was from Krabbe that Julio Alec, well, Alec McKenzie, and Julio McKenzie, and then the present Julio that we know now, and the present Harris McKenzie, all these people, well, they derived from Crossbus and Krabbe. But they originally came from the mainland. And Julio Alec was going to make a barrel factory because there's a lot of barrels, barrel making, cuban, making barrels in the yards in Stornoway. So he started to make a factory. So he built that place on Louis Street. Unfortunately, it is now pulled down and housing is put in its place. The last 10 years. But somehow or another he changed his mind when he was half up with his factory, and instead of putting barrel making machinery in it, he put spinning machinery, he put carding machinery. He was particularly concerned with carding to begin with, but then he put spinning machinery in, as far as I can find out. Probably was the first one to put in spinning machinery in the airport. So it was off from that point onwards. Now there's a lot of controversy about mainland yarn, mainland spun yarn, and island spun yarn from the time the Mackenzie Mill was opened, which is variable dates given, possibly 1909, thereabouts anyhow. So in the second decade of the century, and then the war intervened, the First World War intervened in the second decade of the century, and things slowed down, but demand came as well, you see, because of the war. And in after the war years, things were pretty bad, and more yarn were taken from the mainland because they would get better yarn in the mainland, and cheaper, slightly cheaper, but particularly better quality yarn. And remember that neither the machines from the mill spun yarn from the island or from the mainland didn't qualify for the stamp. So the next thing that happened is a lot of people, a lot of these small producers and merchants in the 1920s started taking in more and more yarn from the mainland. And indeed almost Newells themselves started taking in yarn from the mainland. And Smith's Mill, which was in Peterhead to begin with, started sending in yarn here to be woven as Harris Tweed and calling it Harris Tweed. But it wasn't Harris Tweed because it couldn't qualify for the old mark. Then a fellow from Loughs again, who was mainly instrumental in bringing forward the modern Harris Tweed industry that we know now, Seamus also Hamish, James MacDonald from Nine Abbott, later known down to one or two Abbott. He was a young man, second cousin of mine, a very able person. He was in the First World War for a while, and then he went into Trawlers, and when he was walking around Leith, he saw an advert in a paper, somebody looking for an agent to sell wholesale grocery in Stornoway. So he applied and got that job, and he came up to Stornoway on a bicycle, and he was going around the shops selling wholesale grocery. And then he set up the building that is now the Gazette building. That's a building James McDonald had. And he started importing yarn because he was from Loch, he was quite used. Most of the yarn, most of the tweed, incidentally, was made in Loch Sanuig, the district next to Paris, and Loch particularly. And because he was a Loch man, he knew all about tweed, so he started taking in, imported yarn from the mainland. And he had a yarn place at the back where that bookshop was, at the back of the Gazette office there, you see, on off Kenneth Street. Now they're the Pakistani, I don't know, I can't remember, did he pull down that building or not? Well, anyhow, he's building a new building there. So that's where Seamus Al-Sadim's from half was from, his own mainland spun tweed. And then either he asked or his employer to come in with him, or whoever asked, whether it was a employer or himself, I don't know. But they set up a mill where the the co-op is now. It's in the Harris Tweed Mill there, down at Seaford Road. Now that was a building that lay empty there. That was a canning factory of Lord Lever. But Lord Lever never, although he was in machinery, he never started up the canning factory because the bottle fell out of herring industry, fish industry as a whole. Then he himself died in 1925, anyhow. So the building lay empty there until James MacDonald, the man from Lords, came round, and Archer from Leeds, I don't remember their name, that was the people that owned G&G Todd, the wholesalers which he was agent for. So the two of them went in to James MacDonald Limited. And there wasn't a finishing or anything like that. Probably I have all that in the paper, so I don't need to be going over that. He was the first person in Lewis to put in a finishing plant. And then Kemp's came and put in a finishing plant in conjunction with Kenneth McKenzie. And Newell's put in a finishing plant because they couldn't apply the Orb stamp without a finishing plant. And James MacDonald started agitating in the late 20s, or about 1930, to have the Orb mark amended in a way that it would include mill-spun yarn. So there was a terrible controversy there about 1930. Until it was amended in 1934. Now, I remember these years because I left school in 1930 and a terrible hullabaloo about the stamp, all the old folk. You see, the crofters didn't want it amended because they were afraid the mills would take the whole industry, and so they did, you see. And they did the crofters out of it in the end. Whether that's a good or a bad thing in the long run is another thing. But it was inevitably going to finish off the small producers. Now, way back in the 1920s and 30s, at that time, everybody made a tweed of his own wool. And you took your wool over to the mill in Stornoway. And after they put in finishing plants in the early 1930s, well, they dyed. They dyed the your wool, and they spun your wool, and you went home with your bag of yarn, and you made your tweed. Or perhaps you spun it white as it was, and you made blankets with it. And bedspreads, quite again. Show you some of these around you. And I'll leave the rest of it for the beef part. And if we want a discussion, then all of our discussion. On second thought, perhaps I should say a word or two about the way things are turning out at present. We now have double width rooms coming up, and that's causing difficulty, and I'm not going into that. Maybe it's causing difficulty to people in Varnish. And whether it's going to be beneficial to the industry in the long run, well, one has to wait and see. Myself, a little bit skeptical of it all. And you see, for one thing, you see, you can buy a double width tweed, very similar to Harris tweed, anywhere from here to Japan. But you wouldn't be able to buy a single width tweed. So it's a matter that we'll have to wait and see to see how it'll work out at the end of the day. Thank you very much. That's the end of my taping point.